Hello, this is David Brim, and I'm the founder of Orlando Entrepreneurs. We are the hub for Orlando entrepreneurship, and our mission is to connect, cultivate, and celebrate our local entrepreneurs. We bring together our local entrepreneurial ecosystem to help impact our entrepreneurs, their companies, and our local economy. Learn more at OrlandoEntrepreneurs.org. Now over to Josh Wilson to get forward with our show.
Good day, everyone, and welcome to Orlando Entrepreneurs. My name is Josh, and I'm here in Orlando, Florida, having conversations with other entrepreneurs, the founders, and those who support the Orlando entrepreneurial ecosystem. And now on today's show, I'm going to introduce you to John Robinson, the president at Lunar. So ladies and gentlemen, welcome John to the show. John, welcome to the Orlando Entrepreneur Show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So why don't you tell us what is the company? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
So Lunar is a technology services and SaaS product company. What we do is we talk to our prospective clients and we understand their challenges and we figure out how to develop a solution, whether that's developing something custom, using our consulting services with existing applications that are in place, or putting one of our SaaS products in place.
Okay, so you're solving problems using technology and software as a service. Could you give us some ideas on maybe a few different examples of how you guys could deploy technology to help people fix their problems?
Sure. The thing that we normally focus on is optimizing sales and marketing processes through the use of technology. And we believe that there has been a fragmented relationship between sales and marketing, between sales and technology, between marketing and technology. Those three departments of organizations have traditionally been at battle with each other. Sales saying marketing's not giving me enough leads, marketing saying sales isn't closing enough deals, sales and marketing both complaining that technology or the IT department is getting in the way of them being able to accomplish their goals. And we saw a real opportunity to fill the void between those three departments, marketing, sales, technology. That gap is large, and someone we felt needed to step in and really understand how each of those small ecosystems work and how to bring them together.
So you get them all to play nicely on the playground, make sure that they're all working towards the same mission and that there is a good cooperation between those departments. Because working in big corporations before, obviously I was on the sales team, but the marketing team wasn't sending us good leads and the marketing team saying we're not closing leads. Technology people are going, where are you both? How come you guys aren't updating the CRM and this and that? So you guys help solve those kind of problems. Is that right?
That's correct. And what we found is that it's not, marketing calling the shots for sales or technology, IT department calling the shots for marketing and sales. It's a unified vision and approach across those three departments is what yields the best results for an organization.
Oh, that's brilliant. So John, how did you get into this world of making sales, marketing, and technology all play nicely together? How'd you get into this?
Me personally?
Yeah. Let's hear your story.
It's quite the story. So I've been in a variety of different industries. So Lunar is not my first startup. We'll start there. Okay. So my first, really where I got my start is in the service industry. So I actually was a DJ at a nightclub.
That's right?
Where the career started.
I love it.
In Ann Arbor, Michigan, where I went to school at the University of Michigan, I was a DJ at the local nightclub there called the Necto. And I, this was through college. I was DJing one-off parties there and actually threw a big party right after 9/11 happened in 2001, because I'm a native New Yorker. I wanted to do something to give back. So I contacted the American Red Cross and I said, I want to put together a party. I found, this nightclub that I've been doing some work at. I want to throw a party there and donate everything to the American Red Cross. So they're like, yeah, sure. We'll take anything that we can get. So I met with the club and then they gave me a night without a venue rental fee. And they said, you know, do whatever you want. It was an off night, and I think it was a Thursday night. Go do whatever you want. Okay, cool. So I start contacting local radio stations, start contacting local PR companies, local DJs in the Detroit area that had a following. And this was, I think the event wound up happening maybe a week after 9/11. So it really wasn't a long time. And it wound up being the busiest night that the nightclub had ever had in their 20 plus year history. So I realized then that I kind of have a knack for this marketing thing. And I was brought aboard at the nightclub to be their resident DJ and then to throw some one-off parties in addition. And, you know, we'll sort of fast forward along, right? I graduate from University of Michigan in 2004. And I realize you know, over the course of my studies there that I'm not going to be a DJ for the rest of my life. So what else can I do? So I start talking to management and I'm like, well, is there anything else I can do? And they said, yeah, we actually need someone to take over booking some of our talent. The talent booker we had has moved on. So I take on the talent booking duties and now I'm responsible for something I've never done before. I have to work my way through figuring out how to navigate the entertainment agent industry and bring in DJs from across the country, from across the world. And we built up a pretty good club night on Thursday nights, and I was marketing for Friday nights, which was gay and lesbian night, and then Saturday nights I was DJing, and I wound up becoming the assistant general manager at the club, and you know, as Seinfeld would say, yada yada yada. It becomes 2006, and I've been graduated from university for 2 years, and I realized, well, being a DJ, I needed to do more. Then running the club, I needed to do more. So I start talking to ownership and I say, I think if this is going to be truly my career, I need to have some sort of an equity position in the nightclub. And they say, John, you took this nightclub from where it was when you joined, which was not doing very well, to being very profitable for us. And we can't do that. You know, we're making too much money.
No way.
And I said, okay, that's fine. I'll stay where I am. And at that point I said, I am going to take what I've learned and I'm going to do it myself. So I wound up finding three other business partners and building a restaurant from the ground up about an hour north of Ann Arbor in Rochester Hills, Michigan. So I know we're talking about bars and restaurants and nightclubs and here you are, how you asking me how I got into technology. So we'll get to that.
But hold on. This is really good. I didn't know this about you. You started slinging disc and you were a DJ, right? And you're spinning records and getting people to dance, but learning how to bring people together, learning how to attract a crowd, how to attract people. And you took a company, which was a bar, from, you know, really bad financial position to a profitable business, to the point where that they're too profitable for you. let me ask you a few questions, because I'm sure you learned a whole bunch about being an entrepreneur and being a business leader, being able to be a DJ. So two questions. Number one, what was your go-to song? Like, what was your favorite song to put on? And then I got another question. So what was your favorite song?
So you got to remember, this is back in the early 2000s. So music was a little bit different back then, right?
Yeah.
Would probably be Yeah by Usher.
Oh, great song.
Yeah.
Yeah. Second question. What is one piece of advice that you have from being a DJ to entrepreneurs? Like, what's one thing you learned as a DJ that's helped you all the way up into you know, your president, like being a president of a company? What is one thing that you could take away from being a DJ?
So people who want to be DJs growing up, which is the new trend now, right?
Yeah.
They think, oh, I'm just going to go and be put in front of a giant crowd and have the opportunity to perform on stage. And the reality of the situation is, what you are given when you are hired as a DJ is the opportunity to be put in front of a crowd. You are basically given an empty room and it's up to you to promote to your family, your friends of friends. So you're essentially being given an opportunity to market in any way that you need to. It's not as much about the music until you get to a point where you have your own following. It's about throwing a party and drawing a crowd and figuring out creative ways to bring people in. Like, it wasn't just show up and DJ, right? I'd have to think of unique themes. I'd have to think of ways to, you know, to market to various demographics at the college in order to have different groups on different nights. And it was definitely, I think actually that's where I was able to learn a lot of what I'm using now in my career almost 20 years ago.
Oh, that's good. All right. All right. Now we could go on to you guys. I just had to ask those questions. Now we could go on to you and a group of...
I'm surprised because there's a lot of other questions you could have asked me about my DJing days, but maybe we'll leave those to a future conversation. So I'm glad it was only those two.
Yeah, we'll do those off recorded line. So so you guys built some... you got a group of people together and you guys built a restaurant from the ground up. You know, talk to us about that. Now we're going into second stage where you're now in ownership.
Sure. So keep in mind, right? Spinning records is not cooking food. So when I wanted to progress from just working from 8 p.m. to 3 a.m., right? I had to expand out in the service industry. It's not just alcohol. There's also food involved. So I had to get partners who not only could provide capital, but also had different skill sets than I had. So I went out and found a partner who really understood the food industry, had run restaurants before, back of house. Went out, found a partner who had experience running front of house of a restaurant. And then there was another partner we had that was, you know, purely in investment capital. And across the four of us, the way that we set up the capital structure was everyone had to bring forward 25% of the investment. So Our total investment was $1.1 million. I am 3 years out of college, and I had to go and figure out how do I beg, borrow, and steal, you know, a little over $250,000. So from the time where I left, where I made that decision at the nightclub, I didn't leave. I made that decision in 2006. I basically gave myself a year to figure all this out, right? Build the business plan for the restaurant, you know, find partners, find investor, and then also raise my own portion of the capital. So along the way, I was putting away money up until the point of, you know, making this decision, and then really focused on saving as much as I could from the point I made the decision until I knew that, you know, we were going to be opening the doors. And then it's figuring out where I could potentially, you know, get any couple of bucks under the bed sheets in order to make this happen. So obviously talked to family members, found out that I had a life insurance policy that my grandfather bought for me that I, when I was 1 year old, that I completely leveraged, and I actually just finished paying that loan back. So leveraged that. And then probably four or five different sources of capital in addition to the capital that my partners brought to the table. So that was definitely a learning experience. I got to go in front of a bank for the first time and present my business plan and hear the feedback of there's no way in hell that we are going to give you anywhere even close to $250,000. But it's good to hear the reasons why and what they're looking for. And, you know, I didn't go to business school. I didn't get an MBA. Like, my brother got an MBA, and I asked him if I should go to school and get an MBA. And he said, you've learned enough in the 2 to 3 years that you've been out of college that, you know, I can teach you anything else that you need to know. It's more about, you know, actually being involved and putting yourself on the line that becomes more valuable than the education. You know, no shame to anyone who got an MBA, including my brother and my co-founder. But there's something to be said about having to learn, you know, the school of hard knocks, right? Yeah. Doing it yourself, getting rejected, figuring out how to scrap dollars together and make it happen. So May of 2007, my restaurant opened up. You know, you would think, oh, I opened a restaurant, a little mom and pop. I had big eyes. Looking back now, I probably almost 25-year-old that you imagine, right? If this failed, my life would have been completely ruined. I would have been in debt up to my eyeballs forever with no means of paying it back. But I guess it's that, you know, that the mindset of I can conquer the world and do anything. And I'm glad I took the chicas. I wound up opening up it was a 6,500 square foot, two-story restaurant in the heart of Rochester Hills, which is right by Oakland University. For those of you familiar with Michigan, it's right by Chrysler headquarters. And this was 2007. And we opened the doors and it was gangbusters. And it was so busy that we had challenges keeping up with the volume. And it was going on like this for 2 or 3 months before it really calmed down. But that was a great learning experience, right? Having to deal with, you know, pivoting on the fly and dealing with customer issues and, you know, realizing that, you know, your menus are physically too heavy, even though they're really cool looking. And how do you adjust on the fly? And then the economy took the tumble in late 2007. And we definitely felt the effects of that. But really the competition, I think, felt it more than we did, because we were the new kids on the block and we were still getting, I think, a larger share of people's pocketbooks than some of our competitors were. So we weathered the storm 2008, 2009. And in, I believe it was 2010, we had enough success where we were able to open up another restaurant. So saw an opportunity about 2 to 3 miles away in downtown Rochester, Michigan, to convert an old post office into a craft beer and barbecue bar. And interestingly, the name of the restaurant, we were trying to come up with a name, we wound up calling it Penny Black, which was the name of the first postage stamp. It's interesting layout, having been an old post office, nice architecture in the building. And that restaurant did well. And we wound up opening a third restaurant, which was a scaled down version of our first restaurant, which was, call it upscale bar food with a large craft beer selection. 2011, I wound up selling my interest in all three businesses back to my partners, because we were successful and I think it was time for me to move on and figure out what else I wanted to do. I had started to get some interest in social media, which was really starting to be an interesting time for social media and right around 2010, 2011, 2012. And talked to a couple guys I went to college with and said, I really want to create a social media sports aggregation tool. So sold my interest off in the restaurants, started this project with them. And I'm sure you're going to ask me questions about this process along the way. So I'm going to pause for a second.
Yeah. Yes. What a interesting story. So, you know, going from, you know, spinning discs to, you know, opening up your own and then opening up, you know, multiple locations and going from, you know, going from that kind of progression is really interesting. So I'm sure you learned a lot. Like, I call it like knowledge stacking, like at every single new opportunity, you learned new things. So when you went to go sell your shares or your position in the company, this is something that I think, a lot of people would be interested in. You don't have to give us numbers or specifics, but maybe you could share the process of exiting a partner. Right. So because you had, you know, there was four altogether. How do you go about doing that? And if you went back and did it again, how would you do it maybe differently? So maybe some wisdom that you could share in there.
Well, so in addition to, you know, my interests starting to be elsewhere, you know, having worked, I can't even tell you how many hours a day, 6 to 7 days a week, for 5+ years, you know, it grains on you, right? And partnerships evolve over time. You have to be very strategic about the partners that you get into business with. And their interests were starting to go in other directions. They wanted to take the restaurants in different directions than I did. I was less interested in, you know, how we were cooking the next meal and, you know, what the next drink we were going to make was. And I was more interested in, okay, we've got three restaurants. How do we scale? Right? What are the initiatives that we can put in place? Again, really focusing on marketing and community engagement, and they wanted to focus on, you know, good things, right? Good food, good service, you know, clean environment. So we just had diverging interests. So, you know, the first step was engaging them in the conversation, right? Hey, I think this might be something we want to consider. And it goes both ways, right? Maybe it's you guys exiting and, you know, me taking over the company and taking the direction I want to take it. Or, you know, since you guys appear to be more aligned, maybe it's me exiting, you guys taking the company in direction that you want to take it. So before you even talk numbers, it's getting that alignment in the conversation without it turning hostile, because it definitely has the potential to take a turn. So yeah, I think it's being able to have those conversations, being open, honest with your partners, engaging in the conversation. And then when it's time to talk numbers, and then it's, you know, now you're not so much partners anymore and you're back at the negotiating table. So, the way that I structured, my buyout was something that, was intended not to impact the company too negatively so that they can continue to operate. I had a structured buyout over a 5-year period. And you know, I didn't take any money up front, right? I felt like, okay, I'm going to exit. You guys are going to run the company. Things are going to go well. And that was that. And, you know, I could say that in, I believe it was 20. So I exited in 2011. I think in 2015, I think they went bankrupt, unfortunately. So, you know, there's a lot, I think, that happened. I wasn't really engaged until the checks stopped coming. But that was, it was interesting to kind of hear second and third hand about what was going on.
Sure, sure. Absolutely. So if you had to do it differently going back, you know, having partners, you were a part of a group with, you know, four people total. If you had to go back and do that exit differently or even set it up differently, what advice would you have for yourself before you made that deal?
Yeah. So, yeah, I think, again, knowing what I know now, right, having not seen the entirety of my 5 years of payments come to fruition, you know, I would have been, had more of my own interests and tried to get, more of an upfront payout as opposed to structuring the deal the way that I did. And maybe also if I was going to do a deal that had a structured buyout like that, really think and analyze what's being left when I leave. Because if I'm relying on the infrastructure that's staying in place and the leadership that's staying in place to continue to run the business, what am I taking away, right? They may not think that the things that I think are valuable are valuable, and which is why they're allowing me to exit and want to take the company in direction they want to take it. But, you know, truly understanding the value that you bring to an organization if you're not going to just, you know, walk away with a golden parachute, which I didn't do. So, yeah.
Yeah, good advice. Because you left a gap when you left, because you brought your talent with you. So you now brought this talent, and you reached out to a few friends from college, and you said, "Hey, this social media thing is really getting interesting. Maybe we should start some type of business or service there." So that kind of projected you from thinking about restaurants, which, you know, you learned a lot about how to attract people, how to bring people in, which you learned from DJ World. And then it kind of goes into, well, maybe the social thing is the next hot thing, right? What did that look like for you?
So I really started with the problem, right? As a consumer of sports, right? I wanted to see what was being said by people who actually knew what they were talking about when it came to a specific team or a specific game. So I had a hard time, again, like earlier days of Twitter, unstructured days of Facebook. I wanted to know from the athletes on a given team, from the broadcasters on a specific team, from you know, the cheerleaders on the team, right? People who are officially associated with the team, across all social media channels, what are people saying about a team? And when an upcoming game is coming up between two teams, I wanted to see the all of those representatives from one team and all the representatives of another team both talking about the same shared experience. And I said, okay, well, there's nothing out there that does this yet. Can we build something? I had no monetization method in mind. It was just about reaching critical mass. And that was always the conversation with my partners, that was, how do we reach critical mass with a product? Forget money. We'll figure that out later. So we put a plan together and we just started building. And we were aggregating Twitter and Foursquare and Facebook. And we were building these lists of these official people from each team, and then dynamically creating combined pages every time two teams would face each other. And we built the prototype, and we were using it ourselves. And it was fun, you know. It was something that we built in maybe 6 to 9 months, you know. It was a side project for my two partners. And for me, it was, you know, I just left the grind of, you know, 7 a.m. to who knows what time at night, you know, Monday through Sunday. And it was fun for me. And I did that until I came upon another opportunity, which is what led me to where I am today.
Got it. So, okay. Talk to us about where you are today.
Sure.
Tell us about Lunar and about, you know, your role there and what you guys are doing.
Sure. So Lunar is actually a division of another company. Our parent company, or our company, is Launch That. So it's a digital marketing company. We're located in downtown Orlando in the Plaza. We actually have purchased the building at One South Orange. So we'll have a new headquarters in October. And we, as Lunar, are a technology consulting and SaaS product company that was formed out of the operational division of Launch That, which I created 3 or 4 years ago, to help optimize the way that Launch That was doing its marketing business. When I joined the company in 2012, everyone was a marketer. I was hired as a marketer. There was an HR person, there was a bookkeeper, and everyone else was a marketer. And there were 45 people at the company, 2012. And as we continued to grow and grow and grow, at some point you reach a crossroads where you need to have some infrastructure. You can't just be this like rapidly scaling startup where everyone just produces your product. So I formed this operational division at the organization, and really what our focus was how do we make sure that the things that we're doing at Launch That are structured, are backed by technology, are efficient, are repeatable, are scalable. And that came through two different avenues. There was optimizing the existing platforms that were in place, which, at the time, there was a proprietary CRM that was being used, and we decided that we were going to pivot and we're going to put Salesforce in place. So optimizing Salesforce and the other tools that were being used, and building custom applications to solve problems in a unique way that fit Launch That's business model. And we did this for a few years, and our team continued to grow, and we had built some proprietary applications that had continued to evolve over time. And about a year ago, we made the decision of, wow, this division, this operations division of our company, is providing so much value in such unique ways that we think we can actually provide the same value to other companies as well. So why don't we break it off into a separate division? We called it Lunar to kind of play off the space theme of Launch That. And we continue to be the operational department of Launch That, while also now providing the same consulting services, mainly in Salesforce, for existing applications, and then, you know, taking our products to market, polishing them off, and making sure that they were not just Launch That useful, but useful to any business.
Got it. So so Lunar is a spinoff from the parent company, Launch That, which you were a part of building that. And the vision that you were helping lead and guide became so valuable to Launch That, that you said, you know, maybe this could actually provide services for other people. So you said, let's spin this off and build this out. When you spun off Lunar, what year was that about?
That was just this past year. So,
oh, wow. So yeah. This is new. It's exciting.
Yeah. We officially, like, to the outward world, became Lunar in February.
Awesome. So how's it going? So now you guys have figured out how to solve problems internally, right? And how to fix, you know, sales and marketing issues with technology. You found that you guys were doing a great job doing that internally. Now you're going external to help other companies. How's it going in that?
It's going very well. When we said this is what we want to do, right? We want to help companies solve problems, integrating sales, marketing into technology, we really thought the focus was going to be the products that we've built. We've got some consulting services that we think we can leverage in the short term to help generate revenue and support the company while we scale our SaaS products, because software is a whole different ballgame, right? You have to make sure that you have the right product, the right market fit, the right strategy to market it and sell it. And then you actually have to go out and execute that. So we knew that that was more of a long-term play, and we thought consulting would sort of bridge the gap in the short term. And we had one product that our first product that we released is called Shuttle. It's a lead collection, user tracking, and lead distribution application. That product is we found that it actually had a lot of stickiness with our consulting clients. So we would talk to a number of different local clients that we have here in Orlando, and we'd come in, we'd understand what their challenges were with sales and marketing, and inevitably they all had very similar issues. Their leads are coming in and they are being printed out at the front desk and handed off to a salesperson, or they're going into a generic email box and that one person who gets that email is responsible for getting that lead off to the appropriate salesperson. And this is the problem that we solved with Shuttle, and why we built it in the first place, is when a lead comes in through a website, we collect all the information that the user fills out on that form, and we collect all this hidden information that users don't submit but is available, like what keyword they typed in if they came through an ad, and what pages they visited, and website they may have come from, and what they clicked, and all this information that you collect about their behavior. And we send all that information wherever it needs to go. So maybe into Salesforce, it may be if you're a mortgage company and the person submitted that their credit score was over 600 and they're from New York, you want that to route to your New York mortgage guy who handles people over with credit scores over 600. All that happens programmatically in our application. So that product really has had a great fit with our consulting clients, because it's the type of product where people need to, it's an issue they don't know that they have. We come in to solve the problem. They say, hey, John, we have Salesforce. We're not really using it the best. Can you help us kind of fix some of these problems and get our sales reps accountable, or give us ROI on our marketing? And then we say, well, let's talk about the way you do things and try and figure out what the real problem is and what the solution to those problems are, and not, kind of piecemeal together, what you think the solution is. Inevitably, our execution here has been consulting and products together, which is not something that we thought would be the case. We thought we would be having some consulting clients, we would have other product clients. We never really thought that we'd be able to fuse those together, and that's what we're seeing happen a lot.
Oh, that's genius, because you're consulting people, and as you're learning about the problems that they have, you say, well, we actually have the technologies that could solve those problems. Or it also gives you insight to say, maybe we should build that to solve these problems, because we keep hearing these problems over and over, right?
Yeah. Yep, absolutely.
Okay. So you guys launched in February. You guys are now serving, external clients and growing this side of the business. Like, where do you see the future of your yourself and Lunar going?
So we are expanding out the breadth of products of that we have expertise in on our consulting side. So we do a lot of Salesforce work. Salesforce is very broad itself. There's the main CRM, there's marketing tools, there are sales quoting tools, there's a lot of development platforms that Salesforce has built and integrates with. So we are expanding out our knowledge base to be able to handle more complicated Salesforce implementations and optimizations. And On the product side, we are continuing to refine Shuttle, and we are releasing our second product the end of July, early August. We see ourselves continuing to encounter problems through consulting, and then, as you said, develop solutions that we can then implement for our consulting clients, and people can just buy the products themselves if they just want to implement them on their own.
I love that business model. What advice do you have for, let's just say, consultants out there, right? So you guys are, you know, you provide this consultancy to kind of look at their sales and marketing and technology, see how they're currently doing it. Most time they'll say, hey, we have a Salesforce problem. And you go and you go, okay, actually your problem is this. But like, how do you go about, and you, like I said, you know, just share as much as you can or would like to, but how do you go about pricing those kind of services? Because I think a lot of, you know, consultants have this like spinning dashboard of how much should I charge? And they throw a dart at a board and, you know, to guess, like, how do you go about charging? Yeah, I'd love to hear your advice on that.
Sure. No, this is something that actually spoke about with my partner a couple months ago. So we had originally envisioned that our consulting engagements would be based on hours. So, you know, maybe we'll get a client and we'll sign them to a contract and we'll be doing, you know, 20 hours or 40 hours or 100 hours of work a month. And, you know, the idea would be to sign them to some long-term contract and we'd have this bucket of hours of use it or lose it. While that may be a good decision for short-term profitability, we felt that that wasn't the best way for our customers to be billed. And the reason why is because it didn't mutually align our interests. So for instance, if we wound up doing something very quickly, it was actually counterproductive for us because we were getting paid less. Even though we may have found a great way to do something quickly, we were actually incentivized to take longer to do things. And we didn't like that. We don't want, you know, competing interests. We want to be completely aligned with our clientele. So what we do now is we do value-based pricing. So we evaluate, you know, what is the level of effort that we think something is going to take. And we may be right and we may be wrong. And we estimate approximately the amount of hours that we think it's going to take and build in our margins. And then, excuse me, we deliver a proposal on this is an all-in price. And if we wind up being able to leverage some things that we weren't expecting, get it done quicker, it just means that your project gets done quicker. And if it winds up taking us a lot longer because there's intricacies that we didn't account for, then it takes us a lot longer and it just erodes into our margins a little bit. But the customer knows that this is the price that they're going to get. And I'll tell you, there's a longer sales cycle when you do that because we have to make sure that we fully understand what we're getting into, which is what does align us with our customers. What has happened is that we've wound up having two or three discovery sessions with some of our larger clients where we're solving problems along the way, but it's helping us understand what the real issues are so that we can deliver a fully scoped project that everyone signs off and says, yes, if we are going to accomplish these things by the end of the project and we're going to pay X amount of dollars for it. And on our side, as a consultants, we know exactly what we're getting into. And, you know, we build in the amount of time that it takes to do the discovery sessions and everything into the value-based pricing. But by the time we get to the second or third conversation, the clients are already understanding that we're going to be providing value because we've already given them value.
Yeah,
in
those, I like that.
First and second conversations.
Absolutely. That's great. You know, I've seen many different financial models and business models, but I really like this. My fear in this is, you know, like, I would love your input and your advice on this. My fear is if we go through the whole discovery process, you know, it's very costly to go about doing that. What if they say no, or what if you solve their problem in the discovery process, right? Like, how do you go about accounting for those kind of costs as you're building and growing, you know, your own business and bringing on teams and such?
So probably the best marketing that you can do as a consultant is great work for a client. Whether or not you're getting paid for it, if we go to someone who we think we're going to get a contract, and we wound up solving all their problems before we sign a deal, they are either going to come to us with their next problem, or they're going to tell someone anecdotally that Lunar was able to solve the problems for them, and we'll get the business elsewhere.
That's awesome. What a great way to look at that. John, so where do you see you launched your first product, Shuttle, and it's doing really well. You're helping a lot of businesses. Lunar's growing and expanding. You guys just bought a new HQ that people could go and take a look at. And you're launching your next product within the next month and a half. Where do you see yourself heading, 1 year, 5 years down the line? Like, where do you see this going?
It's an interesting question. And something that we talk about a lot, right? If Lunar continues to grow, does Lunar become a completely separate company? Does Lunar stay a division of LaunchThat? Do we break off consulting and product divisions? Do we eventually sell off individual products on an exit and then continue to incubate? I think because we're so early in this process and we're trying to understand what is going to stick and scale, I don't think I can give you an answer to that I would feel comfortable, you coming back to me a year from now or 5 years from now and saying, hey, John, you said this. How come this didn't happen? Yeah. We're in an interesting place because we're essentially a startup within an existing company.
Yeah.
So
I think that was a good answer. The answer is, here are a few possibilities, but who knows? Like, it's a new startup. There's options, but you guys have thought through those. And I think that was a perfect answer, John. I think that was very simple. So let me ask you this. What advice do you have for people, for other entrepreneurs looking to build a business for themselves, and they're just getting out of college? They're at that point where you are, spinning disc, and they're right there. Like, what advice do you have for someone who's destined to be a future entrepreneur? What advice do you have for them?
I would say it's really important for you to learn the ropes and get the risk out of the way early. Maybe not in as large of a dose as I did, but test out different things. See if you can find something that sticks. Put a little bit of your own money on the line. I've found that the best employees are the ones who have had the experience of understanding that if you don't execute good work, that it's going to hit your pocket personally at the end of the day. We have a culture here of entrepreneurs, right? There's a lot of people on the team who have either been a part of other startups or have, had side hustles or, had run their own small companies as independent contractors with a few employees before they joined our team. And I think that's something that we're trying to continue to grow and breed at our organization. And if more people did that early on, I think they would understand and know really what it takes to be in a part of a successful company, ours or any.
I like that. It's buy-in is so important, and nothing gets you committed like dollars out of your own pocket, right?
That is, at the end of the day, that is the thing that gets you committed, right? If you know that if I work harder, I'm going to make more money. And if I slack off and want to take off a couple of days, I'm going to make less money. Then that's less money at the end of the day has an impact in your personal life as opposed to just having an impact in your professional life.
Absolutely. So as we're wrapping this up and as you work in the startup, what you guys are building, which is growing and doing really well. Like when you get home and you go to unwind, do you ever just like take out the old, disc and you start spinning again, listening to some old Usher? Like, is that the way you deregulate from the day?
I retired my turntables. I have a small music production studio in the corner of my bedroom where if I need to escape, I put my headphones on and I make a little bit of music and then I put the dust cover back on and I won't touch it for a month or so. That's the extent of it right now.
Perfect. So let's ask you this. If there's entrepreneurs in the audience and they want to learn more about your business, learn more about you, how to connect with you, and you know, maybe just get involved with what you guys are doing, maybe be a part of your startup, how could people find you?
So our website is belunar.com, BELUNAR.com. You can also find us on LinkedIn. You can find us on Instagram. You could find us on Twitter. And then me personally, my Twitter is at jrobinson82. So feel free to reach out. Any questions? We'd love to connect to anyone who is interested in what we're doing.
Awesome. So fellow entrepreneurs listening in at Orlando Entrepreneurs, you know, thank you for being a part of this audience and being a part of the show. You've been a part of this conversation with myself and with John, the president at Lunar. If you want to connect with him personally and learn more about the business, you could go to the show notes and click on the show notes, which will drive you directly to him and his business. So John, let me ask you one more question. Is there anything that I should have asked you that I just didn't ask you? And you're like, man, I'm just dying to tell the people about.
What's our second product?
What's your second product, John?
Oh, I'm glad you asked, Josh.
Thanks, man.
our second product is, it's a product that allows companies to visualize text message conversations that their salespeople are having with prospects within Salesforce. This was an issue that was actually presented to us by Salesforce account executives at Dreamforce. I was at a dinner with them and asked the question, if there was one problem that you would love solved, what would it be? Because we love solving problems. And they said, personally for us and for our customers, it's something that we haven't figured out how to solve yet, that a lot of sales are now moving to text messaging. Less on the phone, more in text message. And there are a lot of ways to log phone calls programmatically and emails log programmatically, but no one has come up with a way to log text messages programmatically. So we came back from Dreamforce and we architected a solution, and our solution allows organizations, sales organizations, to not only log those text messages in Salesforce, but we reduce the friction and we allow the process for salespeople not to change. They're using their native text messaging app. It's the exact same experience. We're just able to link up the person that they're texting with to the record in Salesforce and then visualize that conversation so that they or their managers can go in. They could see the context of the conversation that the salespeople are having with their clients.
Wow, that's so interesting. So you went to a conference. The actual execs at Salesforce were saying, hey, this is an issue that we are having as Salesforce. And you also saw that your customers were moving more from calling to text message sales. So you're solving a problem for Salesforce. You're also solving a problem for those who use Salesforce as a sales tool. That's brilliant. Mm-hmm. And nobody else is doing it.
Not in the way that we are, no.
Ah, that's awesome. No. Well, hey, yeah. I'm really glad I asked you that second question, John. Yeah. All right. So that's a cool product. When will that be finalized and launched?
We're hoping end of July, early August. It's called Uplink. So as soon as it is available, we'll be listed on our website, and we'll make sure that everyone is aware that it is now available.
Awesome. So as the second outro to the show, thank you guys for listening on this Orlando Entrepreneur Show conversation with John and myself. Really appreciate you guys being a part of the audience. Once again, you could go and view the full show notes, which includes both products, and you guys can learn more about both of those. So John, thanks for being on the show, man. We really appreciate you opening up your history and just sharing your advice with us.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure, Josh. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and fellow entrepreneurs listening in, thank you for being a part of the audience, and we will talk with you all on the next episode. Bye, everyone. Bye, John.
Thank you for listening in on today's episode. If you would like to be a guest on the show or start up a conversation with me, Josh, your host, send me an email to josh@orlandoentrepreneurs.org. You can also find out more information on Orlando's entrepreneurial ecosystem, discover resources to help you start and grow your business, and subscribe to future shows by visiting www.orlandoentrepreneurs.org.